Hickok continued writing letters protesting his conviction, and one of these at last bore fruit. The recipient, Everett Stearman, chairman of the Legal Aid Committee of the Kansas State Bar Association, was disturbed by the allegations of the sender, who insisted that he and his co-defendant had not had a fair trial. According to Hickok, the hostile atmosphere in Garden City had made it impossible to impanel an unbiased jury, and therefore a change of venue should have been granted. As for the jurors that were chosen, at least two had clearly indicated a presumption of guilt during the voir dire examination. When asked to state his opinion of capital punishment, one man said that ordinarily he was against it, but in this case, no. Unfortunately, the voir dire had not been recorded because Kansas law does not require it unless a specific demand is made. Many of the jurors, moreover, were well acquainted with the deceased. So was the judge. Judge Tate was an intimate friend of Mr. Clutter. But the bulkiest of Hickok's mud pies was aimed at the two defense attorneys, Arthur Fleming and Harrison Smith, whose incompetence and inadequacy were the chief cause of the correspondent's present predicament, for no real defense had been prepared or offered by them, and this lack of effort, it was implied, had been deliberate, an act of collusion between the defense and the prosecution. These were grave assertions, reflecting upon the integrity of two respected lawyers and a distinguished district judge. But if even partially true, then the constitutional rights of the defendants had been abused. Prompted by Mr. Stearman, the Bar Association undertook a course of action without precedent in Kansas legal history. It appointed a young Wichita attorney, Russell Schultz, to investigate the charges and, should evidence warrant it, challenge the validity of the conviction by bringing habeas corpus proceedings in the Kansas Supreme Court, which had recently upheld the verdict. It would appear that Schultz's investigation was rather one-sided, since it consisted of little more than an interview with Smith and Hickok, from which the lawyer emerged with crusading phrases for the press. The question is this: do poor, plainly guilty defendants have a right to a complete defense? I do not believe that the state of Kansas would be either greatly or for long harmed by the death of these appellants. But I do not believe it could ever recover from the death of due process. Schultz filed his habeas corpus petition, and the Kansas Supreme Court commissioned one of its own retired justices, the Honorable Walter G. Thiel, to conduct a full-scale hearing. And so it came to pass that almost 2 years after the trial, the whole cast reassembled in the courtroom at Garden City. The only important participants absent were the original defendants. In their stead, as it were, stood Judge Tate, old Mr. Fleming, and Harrison Smith, whose careers were imperiled. Not because of the appellant's allegations per se, but because of the apparent credit the Bar Association bestowed upon them. The hearing, which at one point was transferred to Lansing, where Judge Thiel heard Smith and Hickok testify, took 6 days to complete. Ultimately, every point was covered. Eight jurors swore they had never known any member of the slain family. Four admitted some slight acquaintance with Mr. Clutter, but each, including N.L. Dunnan, the airport operator who had made the controversial reply during the voir dire, testified that he had entered the jury box with an unprejudiced mind. Schultz challenged Dunnan. "Do you feel, sir, that you would have been willing to go to trial with a juror whose state of mind was the same as yours?" Dunnan said yes, he would. And Schultz then said, "Do you recall being asked whether or not you were averse to capital punishment?" Nodding, the witness answered, "I told them under normal conditions I would probably be averse to it. But with the magnitude of this crime, I could probably vote in favor."